Hello again and welcome to the Culture File Weekly with me, Luke Clancy, here with another week's worth of core samples from the cultural crust, or stories as we mostly call them. This week we're preparing for Fat Tuesday down in New Orleans with the Mardi Gras Indians. We're attending pub theatre in bohemianised Phibsborough, discovering the enduring power of disembodied voices with Owen Nolan and reminding ourselves about the words and music of the Irish Art Song Project. But we start with some Shrovetide shenanigans. In New Orleans, round about now, they're gluing the last sequins, threading the last beads, and generally fluffing the plumage for next Tuesday, Fat Tuesday, Mardi Gras. That's the day when the Mardi Gras Indians, neighborhood tribes of lavishly costumed marchers, first display their new suits for the parade season. A few years back, Irish filmmaker Moira Tierney was in New Orleans for the Shrove season to spend time filming with the Indians and crew leaders such as Big Chief Kevin and Big Chief Demon Melanson.
In the Treme neighbourhood, which is one of the oldest black neighbourhoods in the city, the highway was dropped in the 60s as desegregation was coming on the books, as a way of destroying what was a really flourishing centre of commercial activity for the black community, you know, where people go and they could shop and they could hang out and socialise when they couldn't go downtown because it was segregated. So they dropped this massive concrete overpass right down what used to be a beautiful oak-lined avenue. The Mardi Gras Indian community who I was working with on Mardi Gras Day, they came out in and around the neighbourhood surrounding Claiborne Avenue. So it's still a kind of a hub for cultural activities. They come out really early in the morning on Mardi Gras Day, and then they move around their neighbourhoods. They've no fixed route or anything like that. When two tribes meet, they have a mock battle, because the idea is to see which big chief is the prettiest. And there's a whole bunch of kind of ritual movements that go along with it, and they'd have a group of percussionists with them who were singing Mardi Gras Indian songs. And I think a certain amount of the battle is probably like slinging insults as well, you know?
The design of the costume is a beautiful thing. You know, you have a lot of people, family and friends, that get together and they help make those costumes and they help make it Mardi Gras what it is.
The Big Chief, the Flag Boy, the Spy Boy and the Wild Man. And the Spy Boy is always like a block or two ahead of the rest of the tribe because he's checking to see is there another tribe coming. So if two Spy Boys kind of spot each other, they can relay the word back to the Big Chief, who then can decide if he wants to meet that particular tribe or not. Then closer to the Big Chief, the Flag Boy carries the standard of the tribe, which is kind of a long, it's a flagpole, it's not a flag, but it's a long pole carrying the name of the tribe or an emblem or some kind of a symbol. And the Wild Man, I think, is a kind of a free-roaming character. But that's roughly the hierarchy. And there's big queens now as well, more and more often. Yeah, I shoot on Super 8 and 16, because they're light, small, portable cameras, and I like the way film looks. I like the grain of the texture. And I also shoot silent. And I really like working on the image and the sound separately. I think you get a really good, or really interesting relationship that way. I started shooting by accident, really. Big Chief Kevin Goodman, who's a chief of the Mardi Gras Indians, is a friend of a friend of mine, and he invited us out with him on Mardi Gras Day and let me shoot a bit of Super 8. They're sick of particularly white outsiders coming down and filming, especially since Katrina, so I wanted to show them the footage and get their feedback and see were they happy with the way I shot it and how it looked. There was a big chief called Demon Melanson, and he offered to record Mardi Gras Indian songs to go with the footage. Because they have these really specific call and response songs. Spent a whole day recording, I would say, 10 of their songs with his tribe in his house. During the period of slavery, the Native Americans would often help the slaves escape, and they had maroon camps in the swamps, like these independent communities. And, you know, there was a lot of intermarriage and there's a lot of connection.
And we do that out of respect to the Native American Indians who, when the slaves was free, you know, they welcomed us on their reservation and gave slaves somewhere to stay. And as a tribute to that, we make these costumes.
That said, it's something else that's not necessarily officially recognised. And I think for some First Nations people or Native Americans, it's startling to see people in the black community in New Orleans making costumes that are kind of based on Plains Indians costumes. So it could be seen as an appropriation.
At first they thought like, you know, they thought that we was mocking them with the costumes. And but after they found out the real meaning of the costumes and why we do it, then it was like, you know, thumbs up.
And I think tribes in Louisiana have a better handle on what it all represents. And I know that the Mardi Gras Indians have reached out to the local tribes and they've started the discussion, you know. But yeah, it's a complex relationship, I would say.
We keep the culture going with our kids, with the generation of kids and grandkids and great-grandkids and their kids, you know. But it's a tradition that's been going on close to 200 years.
It's total grassroots culture, and I think New Orleans being the, you know, segregated place, it always has been. I think the Mardi Gras Indians up until very recently were not well seen by the administration at all. Like, it was quite a struggle. There was one particular big chief called Tutti Montana. And he brokered a kind of a truce between the city and the different tribes, which made the relationship easier, certainly. Like, there was less harassment coming from the city administration. Ties into the way the city has been changing or has been changed since Katrina, because a lot of elements of black culture are being used to sell New Orleans to tourists, whereas the people who are maintaining this culture are being forced out because of gentrification. Because a lot of the people I was working with, including Big Chief Kevin and Big Chief Damon Melanson, they've had to move out to the suburbs because they can't afford to live in the neighborhoods that their tradition is representing anymore.
Maura Tierney there with the New Orleans Mardi Gras Indians, and the reporter was Louis Scully. Now, is the grand and possibly eternal struggle between real estate and culture better characterised as a tango than an MMA bout? While artists and producers lament the end of temporary spaces, of old warehouses and factories, of abandoned buildings, the clue was always there in the title. What made those venues emerge was spaces in transition. And yes, we'd like to see something useful and progressive built on those lots for a change, but their disappearance doesn't really signal the end of culture, just its moving home. One recent move has been in Dublin's Phibsborough, where above the pub once known as the Bohemian Clancy, it's showtime at the new HQ of the Core Ensemble.
Hello.
Our group of actors are ridiculously talented. They're top class. They're top of their game.
These are the guys. This is Jed and Eric.
How are you? Nice to meet you.
They've written the show and they are performing in the show as well.
And our goal is to really show them off and say, look, these people are amazing to watch. So we're always looking for work that's going to highlight that.
They're both madzers.
I'm Hilary Jaminski. I'm the company manager and producer for the Core Ensemble.
And they're off. Horses, dogs, football, lotto, elections, Oscars, White Christmas, royal names, sex of a baby, alien existence, guarantees and bailouts, strictly, who killed Lucy Beale? You can get odds on anything. What are the odds of me being happy?
Finding an enlightenment.
All that good stuff.
So the Core Ensemble was conceived in 2015, very late 2015, by a group of people who kind of saw a gap in the theatre industry for ensemble companies. So big groups of people who work together consistently rather than breaking apart after each production and going on to form a new family. So our first production was in 2016 then at the Viking Theatre in Clontarf. And I suppose it just grew from there in that the kind of the founding group of people who started working together on that production wanted to stick together and try to grow the family. And now we're at around 15 people at the moment. We're interested in having a home where we can consistently come together on a weekly basis to develop our strengths, to find what we're interested in, and to make work that's going to have a real life, you know, beyond a 2 to 3 week run.
So we're sitting in the Bohemian Theatre, which is a space above the Bohemian Pub in Phibsborough, which itself is in the shadows of the great Phibsborough debate of the brutalist Phibsborough Shopping Centre, which is a very divisive landmark. It's an interesting corner. There's lots happening. Like, you can hear the traffic outside right now. It's very busy. How did you come across the space, and how are you finding performing in it and using it?
So the space is just endlessly fascinating for me. The more time we spend here, the more we learn about its history and everything that's happening around it. And as you say, it's a really interesting little crossroads to be at. This space up here above the bar used to be a real hotspot for artists and the bohemians of the community. And it's just been really exciting to kind of try to bring it back to those roots and breathe life back into it, breathe creativity back into it, and use the space as it was intended at its foundation to kind of have vibrant life and culture filling it as often as we can make that happen. But it was a huge stroke of luck that the Core Ensemble came to kind of make a little home here for ourselves. A lot of our members are local. And it all just came out of a conversation of, oh, wouldn't it be great to have kind of a performing space or a theater space in the neighborhood? And we just started digging and doing some research around what's happening in the Phibsborough area. And we got connected with the wonderful group of people who run FizzFest. And they connected us with Seamus and Alan, who own the bar. And they were totally on board with us coming in here and putting on plays.
First for Mango, 40 to 1.
Sticks in my mind.
Causes a flutter.
Go no further.
Write it down.
Hand it over.
Job done.
£10, 40 to 1.
Sweet. Come on, First Fandango.
Bring it home.
In the soup now.
Waiting.
Here's the piece.
Swimming.
So the space is kind of like, it's very much a lounge type bar. So I assume there are tricky things to work around to put a theatre show on.
There's definitely challenges. I mean, as you say, it is very much, it's a lounge above a bar. So as you said earlier, you can hear the traffic outside. Sometimes it's fine, sometimes it's a bit louder, you know. Halloween night was interesting. We were prepped for loads of sirens, and fortunately it wasn't that bad. But yeah, you know, it's an obstacle that you have to get around. But at the same time, if you go into the Abbey, you can hear the Lewis passing outside. So it's not really any worse than that. It just means that we as artists have to get really creative and really thoughtful about how we use the space to our best advantage. So we actually had the space set up where we had the main stage, and then we had kind of a catwalk coming off of that, and we had audience seated on either side of that. It was a configuration that you wouldn't see in a traditional theater space, actually, because it would be so much harder to configure a black box in that way. So in one way, the space offers a lot more than a traditional theater space would. In other ways, it offers a lot less. So we've got to get creative and thoughtful with things like lighting and sound.
So you're in the middle of a run of shows at the moment.
Yes, Sure Thing. It's a brilliant show. It's a two-hander. It was written by Eric O'Brien and Jed Murray. It's really tight and energetic and fast-paced. There's loads of laughs in it. And on the surface, it's very much about the day in the life of a bookies.
One eye always on the screen.
2 minutes to go.
In the parade.
But there's so much more going on underneath that. That's really looking at questions of gambling culture in Ireland, the dangers of that. And also, it's a really interesting examination of masculinity, what it means to be a male in this context.
The moment.
Peak.
Tense.
Bursting point.
Contain it.
Make it last.
Hilary Zeminski there of Core Ensemble, and the reporter was Áine Gallagher. Sure Thing, by and starring Jed Murray and Eric O'Brien, is at the Bohemian Theatre, Phibsborough, until Saturday night. Do you sometimes hear voices when you switch on the radio? Well, that's perfectly normal. Absolutely nothing to worry about. Really, you should be used to it. In fact, I'm surprised you even mention it. It's been happening for ages, pretty much since radio began. And according to Owen Nolan, new technology is making little dent in the popularity of disembodied voices. Quite the contrary, as we discover in his latest slightly unreasonable point of view.
Think of people listening intently to disembodied voices, and you might picture a 20th century scene of a family gathered around the crystal set mahogany wireless. In our mind's eye, they listen earnestly. Dad may be smoking a pipe to help him in his role as chief processor of information and entertainment. Depending on which country is conjured, the family might be listening to a Winston Churchill speech during the war, if English, a Dick Tracy cliffhanger, if American, and if Irish, the All-Ireland final from Croke Park. For a while in the decades that followed, it seemed that just as sound had driven out silent movie stars with squeaky voices, TV could see off radio, that video would kill the radio star. No. Radio withstood TV, and now it's withstanding the internet somewhat better than TV is withstanding streaming services. Here in 2020, the new wireless and the old wireless seem happy to coexist, like a leopard and a donkey who've developed an affectionate rapport. We like our disembodied radio voices and carry them with us in cars and on buses, in the home and the workplace too, in a way that TV has never quite penetrated. Radio only occupies your ears, so multitasking is still theoretically possible. We can listen and still get on with our driving, our cooking and our dentistry. And while there is much crossover on our small island between the presenters on the radio and those on the TV, we develop different and deeper relationships with radio voices. The people on the radio are in our private spaces. Today's radio may not command the listenership of 40 years ago, but the human voice is again on the ascent. Virtual assistants, which began as a novelty, are now taken more seriously. Siri is improving, although not quite to the extent that she can answer the question, have you improved? Alexa is sold in multi-packs and it seems Amazon won't be happy until there's one in every room. Most lifelike of all is Google Assistant, deceptively realistic, so probably just as well he or she, you can choose, hasn't been given a name. Meanwhile, there are people who will not take the road less travelled by unless GPS or Google Maps can talk them through it. As a nation, we cherish the voices of our radio presenters. The voices in the ads are nearly as familiar, just less cherished. There are, broadly speaking, four types of radio ad. When the next ad break comes along, try this ad breakdown. First up, type one, the voice of the brand. A voice speaks with warmth and authority in the first person plural. At Brand X, we know that eating isn't just about food. On the upside, it's straightforward and uncomplicated. On the downside, it's dull and generally not very convincing. Your brain knows this can't be the fellow from Brand X, as he was with Brand Y only this morning. Included in type one are the public service, if you smell gas, and never climb the pylons kind of ads. Voice of the brand also includes the sort of ad that prompts the question who, as in who's going to tell the boss to lead the voiceover to professionals. Type two, the testimonial. A customer, real or fictitious, speaks about their experience of the brand. On the upside, listeners might relate to personal stories or, if it's a celebrity testimonial, be influenced by those they admire. Even though on several levels, the audience knows the testimonial has been paid for. And just like the owners and bosses in Type 1, some of the random voices may be less than charming. Type 3, the conversational referral, or two customers in a kitchen. This is the chestnut of radio advertising, the pretend endorsement. Person one outlines to person two the amazing problem-solving benefits of a product that they can't recommend highly enough. They swear by it, and they should know they've tried everything else. On the upside, this is a familiar format. On the downside, it's a bit corny, a bit dull, and in an age where authenticity is prized above all, Type 3 has little. After all, it's not even a real kitchen beach, playground, cafe, workplace, and those people barely know each other. Type 4 are the good radio ads, where anything can happen, and we'd like to hear them again. Sadly, there aren't quite so many of these. When radio was invented, it was said to be the first time people didn't have to leave their homes to be entertained. While radio has lost its monopoly on entertainment and information, it can still own exasperation. We do like to argue with disembodied voices. Or don't we, Siri?
A slightly unreasonable point of view from Owen Nolan there. And don't forget, it's very easy to find Owen's other equally slightly unreasonable points of view on Spotify. The search there works pretty well. Now, this guy wants a word. All this week, Culture File on RTE Lyric FM comes from New Music Dublin 2020. The festival where accordions and electro harps crash 21st century orchestral music, and even skateboarding and yoga have a place. Each evening at 6:10 and in the Culture File Weekly, Friday at 7 with me, Luke Clancy, on RTE Lyric FM. We heard in the autumn from cellist, conductor and producer Doirina Nivara about the 50 art songs based on Irish language poetry she'd commissioned from contemporary composers for her Irish Art Song project. Well, that project has finally hit the stage with a concert this week at the NCH Dublin, and with further songs to be sung in March. A good time then to hear again from Nivara and her collaborator, linguist and mezzo-soprano Bríodnaí Grúgan, who created an international phonetic alphabet so that Irish language art songs can be performed by singers everywhere.
It's not commonly known, but when scores in the Irish language go outside of Ireland, no singer can pronounce the words. So it's a huge problem. So Breed has created what we call an international phonetic alphabet pronunciation guide for all the Irish words in the scores. So all the scores contain this IPA. It's an international language, the IPA, amongst classical opera singers, and they understand this. So now it means that any singer throughout the world can open a score and they'll be able to sing an art song in the Irish language.
Doirna said that John had taken one of the poems that I had transcribed in IPA earlier. John has no Irish, that's fair to say, no Irish at all. And he read it just from the IPA and it sounded like Irish to Doirna. And that's the win, that you can map it onto a series of symbols that then anyone can pick up.
My name is Doirna Nivara and I'm the artistic director of the project. And I suppose you could say I had the original idea with my husband, pianist John Hess.
My name is Bríodnaí Grúgan and I was the Cóirleoir Tangán, the language advisor on the project.
It's a new collection of 50 art songs that I've been commissioned from Irish and international composers. And what makes them unusual is that they're all based on poetry and texts in the Irish language. And then there's Jennifer Walsh, who, you know, can always be relied on to come up with something extremely interesting. And her songs were about climate change.
I would agree with you, Doirna. I've never seen an art song score before that requires you to be an expert in prog rock. With her opening song, Unrobot, she was using AI-generated text. So it's about basically mining the internet and self-generating text. So she comes up with this very short and very humorous song, but the idea of generating something from the ether, and I'm fairly sure Jennifer is the first person to do that with Irish, and well done her for doing it.
In the Irish language, there is fantastic poetry, there's fantastic literature, but it just hasn't been included in classical music. And might I say that the Irish language is even more beautiful than Italian, and there's no reason except that it hasn't been done.
I feel sometimes like I was coming to the same conclusion as Dorina, but from the language side of it. There's such an amazing and vital urban music scene in the Irish language. There's no context where it's inappropriate to have Irish. And it felt to me like it hadn't occurred to classical music as a world, not any individual, that it hadn't occurred to them that they're allowed to use Irish in this way. You see the same thing happening with Irish not really being in our theatres in Dublin. Or, you know, it's just a lack of understanding that it's as malleable and as learnable as any language. And I know there's baggage, but if we can do anything with this project, we can show you can actually let go of the baggage. You can actually just listen to these songs, listen to the actors who are reading the texts, take them to yourself, learn them yourself, or just enjoy them as a listener. But that it's about putting Irish on a platform where it is one of the 100 or so minority languages that are just spoken in Europe, let alone the rest of the world.
Doirina Ní Mhara and Bríd Ní Grúgain there. And the next set of Irish art song performances is on March 12th, when Deirdre Gribben and Anne Clear are among the composers premiering new songs. And that brings to a close this edition of the Culture File Weekly. Next week, we're going all in all week long with New Music Dublin, with new music from Dublin and way beyond. That's every day at 6:10 in Classic Drive and next Friday from 7 here on RTE Lyric FM. Till then, bye now.